but we knew She's Not There was a special song, and we recorded it on our first session in Decca Studios in West Hampstead, and Decca released it, and it was a hit, you know, almost immediately, quite quickly.
I'm kind of picturing the two of them with guitars firing lasers out the ends or something like that.
That's exactly what I see, but I feel like it was just a bunch of drugs and paranoia and, you know, a bunch of weird things happening with them.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Vintage Rock Pod, the podcast series that features rock star interviews giving us the rock and roll stories from the 60s, 70s and 80s. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks very much for listening. Now it's just 3 weeks since this series was first launched and I've been genuinely bowled over by the response to it, so thank you very much. Culminating in a full page article in the Scottish national newspaper The Daily Record, a lovely big headline of Shed Zeppelin, a picture of my ugly mug underneath. Now that's because I record these podcasts and the interviews, and if you've seen the videos on YouTube, you'll have seen yourself in my shed. But it's not just a shed. During lockdown, I turned it into a pub, a vintage rock-themed pub. So yeah, a lot of the papers are picking up on this, and I'm getting a nice bit of coverage for it, which is nice, of course. Right, onto matters at hand, and this week's episode of the Vintage Rock Pod has a strong 60s flavour to it. Coming up, I've got a great interview with American author Stephen Tao. He's written a book about the rise of rock music scene in London in the 60s. Now, you can imagine some of the names that we speak about. He interviewed so many people for this book as well, so he's got a lot to say. We'll also be catching up with our good friend Maudie from Los Angeles as well. And a little heads up, there's no quiz this week. It's a packed show, so don't have time to squeeze it in. But it'll be back, I'm sure, on future pods. Right, let's kick off with our rock star chat, and it's with another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Our third in 4 weeks, we've had a drummer on episode 1 in Kenny Jones. John Ilsley from Dire Straits was on episode 2, he's a bass player of course. And the brilliant Bruce Watson, guitarist from Big Country, was episode 3. So it's high time I completed the band and brought you a frontman, a vocalist. Now this guy was part of a band that's still going strong today. They have a load of tour dates that they'll hopefully be able to fulfil in 2021. And as you'll hear from the interview, they're also back in the studio working on new material too. But it's an unusual rock and roll tale, this one. They came up in the early rise of the rock bands and were front and centre of the British invasion of America. They had 3 huge singles over there. They released a seminal album which Rolling Stone ranked in the top 100 albums of all time. And as I've said, they've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Their music is much loved and has been covered by diverse acts such as Dusty Springfield and Santana to the Foo Fighters and Eminem. But as you'll hear, their big success came after they split up. So a big welcome to the Vintage Rock Pod lead singer of the band The Zombies, Mr. Colin Blunstone.
Well, thank you, Paul. That was brilliant. Thank you so much.
No worries at all. It's an absolute pleasure to chat with you. Now, I mentioned that you're a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It sounds like a fantastic place for me to start. But this came over 50 years after your hits were released, all your big singles. Now, obviously, you've toured and you've recorded much more recently than that. But how did it make you feel to still be recognised and lauded after such a long time?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely brilliant that we did get that recognition. It's a wonderful honour to be inducted alongside so many other fantastic acts. And of course, the actual induction ceremony, it was in the Barclay Arena in New Jersey in America. It's home to a basketball team out there, and it houses about 17 to 19,000 people. It was a wonderful evening. It was on TV, TV out there. And I think there were 7 acts that were inducted at the same time as us. And we played. And of course, there were the good and the great of the music business sitting right in front of us. And then 17 or 18,000 people behind them. So it was quite an occasion. It was very exciting.
I can imagine as well, especially being inducted by Susanna Hoffs, who's just wonderful herself, isn't she?
She's absolutely brilliant. And she spoke so well. She's just an absolute natural. She was so eloquent and in part amusing when she wanted to be amusing, and very knowledgeable as well. We were absolutely thrilled that she gave the speech at our induction.
And something which would have made many boys from the 80s proud was the fact that she said, "Your voice is very sexy."
Well, she did. It took me a bit by surprise, that. I looked at her a clip of the ceremony, and when she said that, the camera went on to me, and you could see I'd really sort of jolted because I wasn't expecting that. But yeah, I mean, that was a real plus, yeah.
Absolutely. Now, let's take it right back to the beginning then, to maybe the late 50s, early 60s. I spoke to John Ilsley from Dire Straits recently and says things can be a real happy coincidence how things can kind of work and get together. Now, tell us how the Zombies began. How did it start? Because you're at school, weren't you? School age.
Yeah, we were all at school. I think it really began when Rod Argent saw his cousin, the late, great Jim Rodford, who actually was our bass player in this incarnation of the Zombies. But Jim Rodford in those days was a little bit older than us, and he lived in St. Albans, and he was in the big local band, the Blue Tones, a fantastic band. Rod Argent saw his cousin play in the Blue Tones and loved it so much, he determined to start a band, and that's really where it all started. He had a friend who lived in the next road called Paul Arnold, who became the bass player in the very first incarnation of the Zombies, and I sat next to Paul Arnold at school, so it's just as you said, you know, so much of it is chance. And Paul Arnold said to me, "You've got a guitar, haven't you?" And wisely or unwisely, I'm not quite sure, I admitted that I'd got a guitar. And that was more or less my audition for the band. It was, you know, come to a rehearsal. And we had our first rehearsal around Easter 1961. And I only knew Paul Arnold, the bass player. And that's how we started. Jim Rodford let us borrow all the gear from the local big band, the Blue Tones, and our first rehearsal, I actually thought we didn't sound too bad. But at our second rehearsal, we had to just use whatever we could get together, and we had practically nothing. We didn't have any proper drums. We had one homemade amplifier between us, and it was a bit of a come-down, the second rehearsal, really. But I'm sure, you know, all bands start like that. You have to build up the gear and your playing technique and, of course, your contacts for where you're going to play. It takes time.
Indeed. But that, obviously, the momentum from that age ramped up really, really quickly, didn't it? Because She's Not There hit the number one spot in America. It was a huge hit in the UK as well. But you guys were, what, 18, 19 at that point?
Yeah. Rod and I were both 18 when we recorded that. And we were just 19 when it was a hit in the UK. And it was a hit a few months later in the States. It was Christmas 64-65 that it was a hit in the States, and we would have been 19 by then.
And it's phenomenal, not just the delivery of the song, because obviously the performance is fantastic, but the songwriting as well from Rod, for such a young age to write such a... It is quite a complex song as well, isn't it?
I would say it's quite a sophisticated song, yeah. And I mean, he amazed me. Actually, I think he'd written a couple of songs beforehand, but he'd never mentioned it to any of us. That song kind of started when we'd been introduced to a producer called Ken Jones, who we were going to do a session in Decca Studios in West Hampstead for Ken Jones. And he was just having a chat with us a couple of weeks before we went into the studio. And in the middle of this chat, he said, sort of a pep talk, really, and he said, you know, you could always write something for the session if you wanted to. And then he went on and talked about something else. It wasn't a big deal. And I kind of overlooked that, but Rod Argent and Chris White went away, and they both wrote songs. I think it was probably Chris's first song, and it was Rod's second or third song, I think. And I was amazed when they came back a few days later, and they got these songs. And I think we all knew that, especially She's Not There, although Chris's song, You Make Me Feel Good, went on the B-side of the Zombies version of She's Not There. They were both good songs. But we knew She's Not There was a special song, and we recorded it on our first session in Decca Studios in West Hampstead, and Decca released it, and it was a hit, you know, almost immediately, quite quickly.
And it was almost the first time as well that the world got to see the three things that make the Zombies so unique. Obviously, your vocals are incredible, and everyone talks about that all the time. Rod's his songwriting, and is probably one of the best keyboard players of his generation. But also Hugh on the drums as well. It's very hypnotic the way he plays. It's not a standard 4/4. Do you know what I mean? It's very different.
Oh, it is very different. And I think that there were quite a few Zombie songs. In fact, possibly the better Zombie songs all had a very different rhythm track. And of course, the bass parts were outstanding as well. But sometimes those bass parts and the drum parts were written as part of the song.
Yeah.
They didn't come together as a result of the band jamming. They were written as part of the song. Not always, but quite often.
Brilliant. And just talking a little bit about the British invasion then, because you were the second British band to have a number one in the US. Obviously, the Beatles were the first. So you were prime in front when it came to this kind of thing. Now, how did it feel at the time? Did you realise it was such a big movement?
I don't think I realised how big a movement the British invasion was in the States. It really means a lot to them, because before then, American artists had always dominated their charts, pretty much as they dominated our charts mm-hmm. over here. And I think it opened America's eyes to the rest of the world musically, really. Of course, the Beatles started it. Without the Beatles, none of this would have happened. But as soon as they had their hits there, America could not get enough of British bands. And it grew into a huge movement, certainly musically, but you could also see it in fashion with people like Mary Quant and Twiggy, mm-hmm. photography, David Bailey, in the theatre, and with John Osborne and people like that. And in the cinema, you had people like Terence Stamp and Michael Caine. And being British was suddenly at the forefront of all the arts.
Very cool indeed, very cool indeed. Moving on just slightly a little bit further then, the seminal album Odyssey and Oracle, as I said, Rolling Stone ranking it top 100 album of all time, and other accolades that kind of continue to roll with it. But you guys split before that really became a success, wasn't it?
We did. I mean, that's the sort of irony of it, really, that there wasn't really a lot of attention given to that album when it was released, and it certainly wasn't a commercial success. And yet over the years, and it can only be through word of mouth because no one's been promoting it or marketing it, but over the years it has built up a phenomenal reputation, and it's often thought of as one of the best albums of the 60s. And that's not me judging it, that's Billboard and Rolling Stone and people like that often quoted. I mean, Billboard recently quoted Time of the Season, which is taken from Odyssey and Oracle, as the best single of 1969. In America, it was released a little bit later. And as you said, Rolling Stone has named it as one of the best 100 albums of all time. So it got all these accolades, but there was a huge gap. I'm not sure that this has happened to many albums. So from sort of partial obscurity in 1969 when it was released in America, it's suddenly become a very well known and very well reviewed and thought of album in its own way. I think it's thought of as a bit of a classic, and as I say, it can only have happened through word of mouth. It quite intrigues me how an album can be virtually ignored at the time it's released and then receive all these accolades so many years later. It's a bit of a mystery to me. I've never really understood it, but it's a good mystery, and it's wonderful to get the recognition, even though it has come after so many years.
Absolutely. And just a quick question. Somewhere I read, obviously Time of the Season went huge as well. We mentioned that off that very same album. Were you guys asked to reform, to then come back and play shows and things on the back of that?
Well, we were, but it was never, as far as we're concerned, it was never a serious conversation. I know that people did contact us, but by then, everybody had moved in different directions and were involved with other projects, and it was never talked about that we should reform. You sort of look back and think, well, maybe we should have had a last hurrah with the band and toured, and it could have been our farewell tour. But, that's one way to look at it, but it just never came up. We were thrilled that we had success with Time of the Season a long time after the band finished. It went to number one in Cashbox and number two or three in Billboard. And so that was a wonderful thing to happen. But even then, Odyssey and Oracle as an album was never really a hit. I think it got into the Billboard charts for 1 week at about 98. Well, when you consider it had a number one record on it, it's quite strange that it didn't go higher, really. But that's the story of this album. It was virtually ignored when it was released. And as I've said, sorry, I'm repeating myself, but that's what intrigues me about it, that it should get this recognition so many years after it was released.
Absolutely. Now, I'm aware I'm pressing for time slightly, so we'll fast forward a little bit. But I just want to mention a little bit, because obviously you had a huge solo career under your own name. You've worked with many other projects as well, with Alan Parsons Project, and you worked with Rod and various other things. But I just want to ask you a little bit about Neil MacArthur. What happened there?
Well, when The Zombies finished, I honestly didn't know what to do. I would have liked to have stayed in the music business, but there didn't seem to be an obvious path for me, to be absolutely honest. And so I just needed to get a job. I'm afraid The Zombies weren't very well managed when they were together in the 60s, and especially the non-writers, so that would be Paul Atkinson, myself and Hugh Grundy, we were left with very low funds at the end of the band, and I had to get a job. And while I was doing this job, I was just working in an office, it was the first job I was offered, Time of the Season became a big hit in the States, and because of that, people started contacting me to record. That they hadn't done that at the end of The Zombies, but suddenly they were contacting me, and a particular producer called Mike Hurst, he'd had a lot of success with the early Cat Stevens records and some other things as well. He was a very successful producer, contacted me, and eventually we talked about doing some tracks, and he came up with the idea of just changing my name, and Neil MacArthur came from I know not where. I don't think there was any deep meaning behind it. It was just a name. And he also suggested re-recording She's Not There, which is a kind of a strange route to take. But at the time, I wasn't even sure that I was going to get back into the music business. This was just almost like auditioning again, really. I was going, after a day's work in the office, I was going to Olympic Studios in Barnes and literally just putting vocals on some tracks. And then when they were released, they came out under the name of Neil MacArthur. And the first one, the She's Not There track, was a top 30 hit in the UK. And I think it could have done something in America, but unluckily, another band had re-recorded She's Not There in America. They were called The Road. And they'd had quite a lot of success with that track, and they just beat us to it. They were a few weeks before us. I think otherwise it could have been successful in America. So I had three singles released under the name of Neil MacArthur. And then I was literally talking to Chris White, who was driving me home from a party because we were still mates. And he said, you know, why don't you come and record with Rod and I? So it'd be Rod Argent and Chris White from The Zombies producing me as a solo artist under my own name. And that's what happened. We went to CBS Records and released my first solo album, which was called One Year. And from that, there was a track written by Denny Lane called Say You Don't Mind that was released, and it was quite a big hit.
Yep.
And so I was off and running again as a solo artist. I wasn't sure that I would ever get that opportunity, but just, through the way things panned out, suddenly the door opened and I was a solo artist with a hit record.
Fantastic. And then just fast forwarding to today then, you guys had a tour, and obviously with all the coronavirus and COVID and things like that, it's had to be postponed. But the tour is going ahead in February and March of next year. It is the Invaders Return Tour. What can people coming along to your shows expect to hear and see from you guys?
Well, obviously we'll play all the hits. We usually play some Argent tunes. Because I work with the Alan Parsons Project, we sometimes play a little bit of the tunes that I was involved in with Alan Parsons.
Okay.
But perhaps most importantly, we'll be playing completely new songs from the new album that we're recording at the moment. So I think there'll be something there for everyone. You know, there'll be well-established hit songs that everyone will know, and there'll be some new songs, brand new songs, and from what I've heard so far, they're fabulous songs. So it would be a thrill to play these new songs for the first time on tour.
Absolutely, and that's the exciting point. You're recording some new songs, and you're just mentioning before we started recording there, where you're recording them.
We're recording them in Rod Argent's studio. He's just built a studio in an outbuilding that's attached to his house. So we're the first ones into his new studio, and of course, that's very exciting that there is a new facility there that which we can use. But I think, for The Zombies, the really exciting thing is always to write and record new material.
Yep.
That's what gives us our energy and our enthusiasm to always be working towards the next album. And I think there are very few bands from the 60s left now who are writing and recording new material. So again, it gives us a sort of a privileged place really, because we are one of the few bands left from that era that are doing that.
Absolutely. And if you want to see The Zombies live with Colin's wonderful vocals, then the tour starts on February the 11th in Harpenden. It moves along to Fletching. You've got a couple of dates there. Then Milton Keynes up to Glasgow as well on February the 18th. Down to Gateshead. You've got New Brighton, Holmfirth, Bury St Edmunds, Bristol, Exmouth. And then you're into Wales with a place that I can't even pronounce, to be honest with you. Back to London in March. And then you've got Wimborne, Minster. You're in Taunton. And that's the UK dates. And then you head off over to Norway and things like that as well, don't you?
That's right. Then we'll start the foreign part of the tour. And I think with The Zombies, we do spend a lot of our time touring abroad, which is great because we get a chance to see the world.
Yes.
And what more can you ask than sort of playing the music you love, touring with your mates, and seeing the world as you go along. It's a wonderful life.
It sounds fantastic. So if you want tickets for that, they're available at thezombiesmusic.com/live. And just when I was surfing around on your website as well, I noticed that you've got some zombies face masks.
We have, yes. To my knowledge, we've got two separate ones. One is featuring the artwork from Odyssey and Oracle, the album we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So it's a face mask featuring that. And another one has got a zombies logo. It's a black one with a white logo on top of it. So if anyone wants them, if you go to the Zombies website, I think you'll be directed where you can get them from.
Yeah, they're just on there on your website there. It's perfect. Excellent. Thank you very much for talking to me, Colin. It's been an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to hearing the new music too.
Absolutely. Thanks, Paul. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Such a gent, Colin Blunstone of The Zombies. Definitely keep an eye on their social media and the website and things like that for the news on the tour, especially with all the restrictions and everything we've got in place. And as face masks seem to be here to stay, it's worth looking at those stylish ones too. Definitely make you stand out from those clinical white and blue disposable doctor-looking ones that everyone's trotting about in. Now, if you're not fully aware of their work or The Zombies' back catalogue, now it's that point of the episode where I attempt to point you in the right direction to get you going and give you the Vintage Rock Pod Top 5 Zombie Songs. We start with a story of someone writing to their partner in prison waiting for their release. From the much heralded Odyssey and Oracle album, at number 5, it's Care of Cell 44. At 4, it's the song that rose from the ashes of the band as Odyssey and Oracle went big after the band disbanded. Came back into the UK mainstream a few years ago as well when it appeared on the TV adverts for Bulmers. Number 4 is Time of the Season. Third on my list is actually a B-side, flip side to the single Going Out of My Head from 1967. It's the upbeat, positively raucous She Does Everything For Me. At 2, it's a track that's just 98 seconds long, but manages to pack so much into that time. It's cool, it's moody and unashamedly 60s. It features a keyboard solo, a guitar solo, and 3 quick-witted verses as well, with Colin's vocals doing acrobatics at times. From the first album, Begin Here, at number 2, it's What More Can I Do? And at number 1, we go back to where it all began, the band's first single released in 1964, one of the first songs Rod Argent ever wrote. It still sounds brilliant today. The best song from The Zombies, according to the Vintage Rock Pod, is She's Not There. And of course, give Odyssey and Oracle, the much heralded album, a listen to in full as well. And as always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on these choices. Let me know your top 5 tracks, what you think I should have had in that list. Now, I'm guessing a few people are going to be saying A Rose for Emily. Comment on the YouTube video or the post on our Facebook page too. And to find those, just search for Vintage Rock Pod. Dead easy. Anyway, let's continue with the 60s vibe and make our first trip to America on this episode for a great chat about the rise of the rock scene in London. Now, today I'm speaking to a professor and an author. It's Mr. Stephen Tao.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all, Stephen. Where are we reaching you from today? Whereabouts in the world are you?
I am about an hour north of Sunrise City, Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, very nice indeed. We're in the Highlands of Scotland, so slightly different. But we'll carry on. Just a little bit indeed. So let's begin then. London Rain Over Me, that's the reason we've got you on. But let's take us back a little bit before then, because you'd written a book before that, and that was about Seattle and the grunge era. So what was it that made you go from Seattle in the 90s to the swinging 60s of London?
That's basically because as of being a music fan, you know, the grunge thing really stuck with me because that was like my 60s. I was in my late 20s when Nirvana kind of blew up. And that was, I just didn't get the mainstream 80s. It wasn't my thing. Mm-hmm. And so when Nirvana and, you know, all those bands out of Seattle hit, I just loved that. So I wrote that. Yeah, I wrote that book, and that came out in 2011. And for this book, it's going back to my roots. I mean, again, with the 80s. I mean, I was in college in the early first half of the 80s, and that's when MTV hit. And so all of my friends were talking about the cool new Madonna video or the Michael Jackson video or the ZZ Top video. And aren't all the girls really cute in that ZZ Top video? And I'm like, yeah, but the song sucks, you know? And so that's when I discovered the 60s. That's when I was like, you know, one of my friend's girlfriends gave me a copy of Quadrophenia and she said, you got to listen to this. And I was like, and never heard it before. I'd heard The Who, of course, but I hadn't heard the entire album of Quadrophenia. And that's when I got into, you know, I discovered The Who and Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles, the Stones. And it just was so much more vital to me. So for this, for my second book, I went back to my own roots, really. And went back and said, well, we looked at Seattle. Let's look at London just as a music scene rather than writing just another book about, you know, a famous band.
Very cool indeed. Now, London Rain Over Me, how England's capital built classic rock. Now, the 60s of London, it was the swinging 60s, wasn't it? It became the centre of the musical universe and everything like that. But the roots behind that is very different, isn't it? It's skiffle.
Skiffle was almost like punk rock before punk rock existed. And I think the ideal of punk rock, which is, I guess, because I identify with that because that's where Seattle came from, is that just get up and do it. You don't have to be educated for, you know, your entire life training on an instrument to be able to just do it. And skiffle, you don't have to have any money, really, for skiffle. And the kids growing up in England after World War II didn't have any money. So it was a cheap way to kind of have a lot of homemade instruments to put together a band, and everybody did it. I mean, you know, the Kinks, Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, all those people started in skiffle groups.
Absolutely. So when you were researching the book and you were going about trying to get interviews and things like that, what did you focus on first? What did you think was the main thing that I'm going to have to get into this first to move on to something else?
Well, really, you know, where it came from. You know, and I kind of had an inkling, you know, of where, you know, the whole, the blues and especially, you know, American blues kind of originating in the South through like Chicago and stuff. But what was really fascinating, you know, I knew about people like John Mayall and Alexis Corner and stuff, but I didn't know this guy, Chris Barber. You know, I didn't know who he was. And I found out he was still around, still playing trombone. And this was the guy that basically started it. Once I sort of stumbled upon him and he was kind enough to talk to me a couple times, that I was like, wow, this guy really did start everything, you know, in England. I mean, he kind of brought over Muddy Waters, his sister Rosetta Tharpe, and Big Bill Broomsey, and all the, you know, young British kids are like, wow, this is really great. What is this? We don't hear this on the BBC live program, you know? So it was really great. So yeah, I think it kind of started with that.
Excellent. You mentioned there the BBC, and obviously, but there was the rise of pirate radio as well around this time, which certainly helped too, didn't it?
It was really important. It's 1964, starting with Radio Caroline, and the BBC would not play that stuff. So you had to kind of, and I think that was part of the thing that was exciting for young people. You know how it is, it's like, especially when you're young, if it's not, you're not supposed to get it or hear it or smoke it, you're going to find it, right? And so, and a lot of the, you know, people like in the Stones and the Yardbirds, they found all these cool records from imports in London shops and stuff. So the pirates, basically, because the BBC wouldn't play this music, you know, these ships, you know, in the North Sea, they would start broadcasting, and they would play, you know, not just the Stones and the Beatles, but they would also play, you know, American jazz and blues, and they really, you know, eventually the BBC were like, okay, we're going to shut that down and we'll do it ourselves, but that took a few years.
He certainly did. So when we talk about London and the swinging 60s and things like that, there are certainly very different styles of rock music, aren't there, around that time? You talk there about folksy side, you've got your R&B, you've got your mods, psychedelia coming in later on. What kind of came first among that? We've talked about the blues, but what kind of followed from there?
Well, that was the challenge for me, because, you know, you could see, like, in London, obviously you had the Beatles coming out of Liverpool, but in London you had the Stones and the Yardbirds and Manfred Band and some of those bands, Georgie Fame, that were really delving into the blues. And then it was like, okay, well, later on, yeah, there's psychedelia and there's prog rock and there's folky rock and stuff. And I'm trying to connect those two, right? And that was a real challenge because it was, and I'm terrible at writing. Like I struggle with writing transitional chapters, and so it's there's not an easy answer. It's because people took different paths to it. You know, some people like you have like a Pete Townsend who's a genius who just basically is like, you know what, I don't. And of course, his manager Kit Lambert exposed him a lot of his classical stuff. So he kind of moved into this sort of proggy direction and then psychedelic direction. So you had that and you had, you know, the psychedelic thing came over and people like, you know, obviously Floyd and the Move were doing that and that influenced a lot of other people, including the Yardbirds. So it's not really an easy answer as to why. It's just, I think it's just, you had this young generation that just wanted to explore and people were buying the music and were open to the music. So I think it was because of that curiosity and, of course, the talent and the time. So people were just, we're just going to try anything. And you could see it almost by the month, like this rule is being broken and this rule, let's try this, let's try that. And it was really, it's amazing. And it's really kind of, you know, I read that and I'm like, man, you know, we're in 2020 in hell right now. You know, and it was such a refreshing time, I think, especially coming out of the war and the aftermath of World War II.
Absolutely. Now, as I said earlier, you interviewed more than 90 people for this book. Now, who did you get hold of that you spoke to that turned out to be a million times better than you expected?
Probably Greg Lake, the late Greg Lake from King Crimson and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I kind of like ELP. I'm not a huge fan, but I kind of like them. But I had no idea. He was just very, you know, you interview certain people and most of them are professional and you know, and you have different levels of how much they'll talk. But he was so warm. I mean, he just was so passionate about, you know, and he didn't even talk so much about his own bands. More, he talked about seeing the Beatles, you know, in 1963, and seeing Jimi Hendrix at Brighton in 1967, and he opened for Jimi Hendrix, and he was just like, "What is this? These three guys, they look like clowns with the afros and the crazy clothes." And then he said they started playing, and we're like, "This is new. This has not happened before," you know. And at that passion. You know, this is sort of a little bit of an aside. I was just thinking about this. Like, you know, I teach this course on rock and roll history, right? And every semester I have them listen to Johnny B. Goode by Chuck Berry, right? You've heard that a million times, right? And I think it was last semester I was like, you know, that didn't exist. Like, Chuck Berry created that out of thin air. And I think that enthusiasm for creating art, you know, getting back to Greg, I mean, he just was so passionate about that, those particular times. So, yeah, I'd have to pick him.
Fantastic. And you mentioned there Jimi Hendrix. Now, he's a fantastic place to start. He came over, obviously, from America and much more accepted in London in the 60s than he was in his own country at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially like now, I mean, we're having this Black Lives Matter thing going on here, you know, and so we have a whole other set of issues. So, but the same type of thing, you know, and so... Hendrix was, especially in the 60s, we're still kind of in the midst of the civil rights movement here, and segregation and, you know, separate water fountains and all that nonsense. And so he comes over to the UK and it was completely different. And people looked up to him, and like Eric Clapton, Pete Townsend, and, you know, obviously very accomplished musicians are looking up to Hendrix like, this guy, what? You know, Neil Young once described Jimi Hendrix. He said he played guitar like he was living there. You know, and it's also, I mean, Hendrix is later, but even like a lot of the blues guys that came over to England in the 50s, they were like, wait a minute, white people are being cool to us. Wait, they even appreciate, they even like what we're doing. So, very, very different atmosphere than here.
Absolutely. Now, did you discover any bands that you didn't know about, maybe that have been lost in time and you thought, absolutely fantastic, why have I not heard of these?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a few of them, the Pentangle being one. I'd never really heard of them. And I knew who some of the players were, you know, Bert Jansch in particular, but I didn't know so much about that particular band. And I was like, they were just this very unusual, like acoustic, but not kind of folky, yeah, definitely folky, but also bluesy. And you kind of, there were no limitations on what they would do. The drummer played with brushes. You'd sit down at a Pentangle show like you'd go to the Philharmonic. You'd sit down and you would clap politely when they're done, you know, because you don't want to be, you want to hear everything, every note that they're playing. And so they're fantastic. And I think it was also cool that, again, the audiences were receptive to go see the Pentangle. You might have the Pentangle and, you know, like, I don't know, Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin on the same bill. And people be like, that's cool. You know, wasn't like now, can you imagine seeing that? I mean, it's everything has got to be the same exact genre of what you're seeing. And it wasn't like that. So that was an example. I'd say, I mean, I discovered a lot. I knew about Fairport Convention, but I really, well, Sandy Denny. I mean, anytime you hear Sandy Denny sing, it's just like, you know, really the hair stands up. And I was fortunate actually to get Judy Dybel, who was the first singer for Fairport, to talk to my students a few times before she passed. So, yeah, that was the Straubs is another one. They were like, they kind of like, they started out as sort of this hillbilly duo playing like, you know, bluegrass, and then they ended up becoming sort of proggy. So, yeah.
Bill Bruford, he wrote the foreword for your book, and I mean, that's fantastic. How did you manage to get that one?
Still not sure, really. Bill is a very thoughtful, very serious person, and brilliant. And I had to jump through a bunch of hoops to get an interview with him because he wanted to make sure that I was serious about this, that I had done my homework, that I was going to ask him a bunch of stupid questions. And so finally agreed, and I interviewed him in Guildford. And, of course, I got on the wrong train, but that's a whole other story. Actually, I'll tell you that story since you want to hear stories, right?
Okay. Yeah, go for
this
it. Go
the
for
greatest
it.
Story in the world, but it's a story. So we set up a time. This is like, I don't know, I think this was 2013. And I was like, okay, you know, we'll interview him at the Guildford train station, a little coffee shop. He gave me the time, you know, whatever. And I got to Waterloo Station, London, ready to go. Spilled coffee on myself, of course. And then I get on the train and, you know, going along. And I'm like, I'm supposed to be there at 10:30. And got on the 10 o'clock train. And it's getting later and later. And I'm like, we're nowhere near Guildford. And realized I got on the local instead of the express. So I'm starting to panic. So I'm trying to get hold of him every possible way, texting, calling, email, nothing. And I'm like, I blew this interview. I blew an interview with Bill Bruford, right? So I don't know what to do. And finally, about 20 minutes late, I pull up to the train station. My phone rings. He goes, hello, Stephen. Are you coming? You know? And so he waited. He was about ready to leave, but I think he probably felt sorry for me. And we did the interview. It went well. But when it came time for the foreword, my publisher says, you know, reach out to some prominent people, obviously. And I gave a list of people. And then I was like, wait a minute. Because he wasn't on the list. I was like, it's got to be him. For some reason, it had to be him if he'll do it. And he did it. And I was sending him parts of the manuscript as I was writing them each time, telling him, look, this is crap. This hasn't been edited. So, you know, but he was very, very cool about it. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, Stephen. I could chat a bit longer, but I just don't have the time. So just let's just plug your book. Whereabouts can we get your book then?
Probably the best place since everything shut down, I guess, is like Amazon or, I don't know, Barnes & Noble. I think Waterstones has it over there. So, you can get it pretty much anywhere online.
Perfect. And that's London, Rain or Me, How England's Capital Built Classic Rock. Thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us on the Vintage Rock Pod.
Thanks for having me on, Paul. It was a lot of fun.
I definitely recommend you check out the book London, Rain Over Me if you love your classic rock tales. Big thanks to Stephen for joining us. Now it's time to speak to our good friend Maudie from the History of Rock Facebook page and Ranker.com over in Los Angeles to find out some more fascinating facts and tales. Now, as this episode is coming out just a few days before Halloween, and we've had on the Zombies lead singer, that's kind of pretty apt name for a Halloween episode, isn't it? I'm sure Maudie will have something equally spooky lined up for us.
Yes, sir. We're going to be taking a look at David Bowie's, you know, mysterious connections to the occult and paganism, as he famously has been intertwined with Satanism and weird things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. So go on then, hit us up. What have you got first?
So yeah, he became a big fan of Sir Aleister Crowley and has always just been looking into the occult, but I think it got the best of him because it was intertwined apparently with his drug use. So he would abuse, mm-hmm. you know, drugs, and which makes you paranoid if you, you know, abuse too much. and this is my first fact, is he actually had a book that would teach you psychic self-defense. He had it on him at all times. He would wear a silver cross all the time. And I think this was actually during the height of his like cocaine abuse, and he was filming The Man Who Fell to the Earth. Yeah, it was definitely not a good time for him.
See, straight away, most people are doing self-defense classes if you've got worries like that. Nobody's going out and buying themselves some sort of cross and that kind of thing. That's strange to start with.
Right, right. Yeah, a psychic self-defense book on him at all times, just in case, you know, oh, I'm getting attacked. But I thought that was pretty interesting, you know, to know.
Let me flick to page 38. Hold on. Yep.
Exactly, yeah. What kind of attack are you feeling? let's see, let's find another one here. I thought this one was really good. So, I don't know, he was living in Los Angeles at the height of his paranoia, I guess. He was convinced that there were demons in his swimming pool. So he actually had somebody come and exercise his pool. He actually paid someone to do that, yeah.
Did the guy turn up with a big net? I mean, how did he get demons out of a pool?
Well, apparently he was just not having a good time in this place, obviously because of the drugs. And he got someone to just come by with like a couple instructions, a few $100 worth of books, talismans, and like just random items of occult backgrounds and tried to perform some kind of a ritual in his pool to get these demons out. Yeah. Apparently he was on a strict diet of cocaine, milk, red peppers.
Talk about it. It's the famous Bowie occult diet, is it? The old cocaine, milk, and red peppers.
I wonder if that's the famous Crowley diet.
Oh, speaking of the exorcism with the swimming pool, I mean, you're talking Los Angeles and you live there yourself. Do you know many people that will come around and do that nowadays if you've got issues with demons in your swimming pool?
You know, I've heard a lot about a couple houses that are haunted and, you know, you'll go by them and it's like notoriously that like, there's been a bunch of celebrity murders and all this stuff, or the Manson family was, you know, so I wouldn't put it past it, because those places are definitely, you know, holding some kind of weird tension. Not that I'm a believer, but so let's see, let's move on to the next one I've got here, which I thought was the most interesting one and probably the last one I'll leave you with, because I think you're going to want to read into this one yourself, Paul. According to rock legend, that Bowie and Jimmy Page went at it with a magical battle. What that entails, I'm not too sure. But
oh, come on.
It says here that obviously Jimmy Page purchased Aleister Crowley's estate, and it came with a bunch of stuff that he owned and all this. Yep. So, but Bowie was terrified of Page, and he was convinced that he was casting spells on him. And yeah, apparently some kind of a ritualistic thing that happened in the studio between them. There was some kind of symbols written on the floor. Yeah, it was just very like weird magical warfare, sending each other little trinkets and stuff. So
that sounds bizarre.
Kind of funny.
I'm kind of picturing the two of them with guitars firing lasers out the ends or something like that, or smoking. Yeah,
that's exactly what I see. But I feel like it was just a bunch of drugs and paranoia, and you know, a bunch of weird things happening to them. I think that one's a good one. Honestly, I would love to read into what happened in that battle. I could just imagine them both shooting beams at each other.
Absolutely bizarre. Now, as always, Maudy, if we want to read the rest of them, because there's 14 facts, isn't there, about David Bowie and his links to the occult and that sort of thing. What
there's
do we do?
14 of them. You can go give me a follow at Facebook at the History of Rock page, or you can just go to ranker.com and search up David Bowie. We've got a ton of lists on him and, you know, a bunch of cool stuff that you definitely probably didn't know or wanted to be reminded about.
Just like him having a crazy battle with Jimmy Page. That's something I needed to know about.
Exactly. who would have ever thought?
Who would have ever thought, indeed. Thank you as always, Maudy.
It's an absolute pleasure, Paul. Thank you for having me.
So that's episode 4 in the can. Quick heads up about what we've got coming up on future episodes, because I've been doing interviews from my pub shed left, right and centre lately. So over the next few weeks we've got some really, really diverse guests coming on, from a songwriter whose records have sold more than 500 million copies worldwide.
got some great stories about the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers, Tom Jones and stuff like that. We've got a British hard rock singer from the 80s whose band released 21 studio albums and toured with the likes of Ozzy Osbourne and Whitesnake, and also a member of one of the leading punk bands too. Loads coming up and all diverse for all types of music. It's what we do here on the Vintage Rock Pod. Also, make sure you subscribe to this podcast series wherever you're listening to this. Give us a review and a rating too, please. All that kind of helps. And tell your friends, spread the word about the podcast. Episodes are released each Monday morning. I wouldn't want you to miss any. Also, give us a follow and join in the chat on social media, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And see the video interviews and everything else on YouTube as well. All you got to do is just search for Vintage Rock Pod wherever you go, and you'll be able to find us. Until episode 5 then, take it easy and keep listening to your rock music. And if you come across anyone who isn't a fan, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.